Hey, it's the Schwarzenegger. I need your clothes, your boots, and your podcast device. Why? Because this October, on the Films and Swearing Movie Podcast, the boys will be reviewing all 5 Terminator movies. Yes, all 5. Even Rise of the Machines, Talk to the Hand, and search Films and Swearing on your podcast apps, iTunes, Skynet, and Stitcher Radio, or visit filmsandswearing.com. If not, consider it a divorce.
That's fucking Torico.
Fuck you, asshole.
Welcome to Podcast on Fire 201 on Wheels on Meals and Crippled Avengers from Hong Kong to Spain and back to Hong Kong and back in time again. For this episode, we follow the 3 brothers. In this case, we're talking about Jackie Chan, Sammo Hung, and Yuen Biao as they take their martial arts action comedy formula to Spain and into a meal van. And then we transfer from 1984 to 1978 and on to the Shaw Brothers lot, where director Chang Cheh were building Iron Man to fight each other, essentially, in Crippled Avengers. So the Venoms are back and are now handicapped fighters. Those are the movies up for review, Wheels on Meals and Crippled Avengers. My name is Kenny B, and with me, post this massive 200th episode celebration, meaning it was a damn long episode. But regardless, Tom KW is here with me, so say hi, buddy.
Hello, guys. How are you? Oh, I just realised we're on a podcast and it's not a phone call to the fans, unfortunately. We'll do a little gap. Fill in this gap with your answer. We'll give you a few minutes.
That'll be fun for me as editor, and that means your little tangent of "this is not live" will be fucking cut.
Thank you for that. I like the fact it's necessary. Cheers.
I could never do a live show. I just am way too conscious of my various and the pauses and all of that. I want my editing. I want to tighten the show.
300, it's happening. We're doing it. There'll be a way where we can all be in the same room with kind of teleportation devices at that point. So,
well, maybe so. I'll be dead by that point. So,
so I don't care.
Because we're so slow in producing these kind of shows. We produce weekly, but Podcast on Fire slowly ticks upwards. But 201 it is. 200th episode was this 4-hour extravaganza, which Tom was on, and now we're back to regularly scheduled programming and sort of length. These shows get into the movie reviews pretty quickly, so I'll try to keep them under 2 hours based on that. So let's get to it. After some brief contact information, this is Podcast on Fire, the flagship show of the Podcast on Fire Network. We are on podcastonfire.com, where you'll find this show and a bunch of other shows that covers a variety of Asian cinema. So you can make your choice, and you also have bonus episodes available to you. Website exclusive bonus episodes, that is. If you have any questions or feedback, let us know at our email address, podcastonfire@googlemail.com. Check us out on Facebook, like our page, and join the discussion group. The relevant links are in the show post on podcastonfire.com. And our Twitter handle is at podcastonfire. I write about Hong Kong movies, Taiwanese movies, and ninja movies. As Tom now knows, he knows my crappy little world that I reside in because I gave him a ninja movie for the 200th episode. But that's why you are the better man.
Well, the better man for not doing this kind of stuff.
Exactly. Because obviously I'm cherishing my living hell by reviewing stuff like Rage of a Ninja over at SoGoodReviews.com. But I review a variety of genres over there as well. And I do small video reviews at SleazyKVideo.com. And my Twitter handle is at SoGoodReviews. And Podcast on Fire can be subscribed to on iTunes. You can also leave a star rating. And if you have the time, please leave a written comment as well. We would very much appreciate that. And finally, stream us on Stitcher Radio. There is an option to comment either on the website or on the application that you can download to access Stitcher Radio. That application is available on the Apple App Store and Google Play. And even though you write sporadically, you have a review archive over at thecinemashow.com. Tom. TheCinemaShow.com. Tom, that was always like a little melody. Even though you write sporadically, we do link to your review archive over there. Where we have a promo break coming up, so listen to one of our friends in the podcast community's promos, and then we'll be back after that to discuss Wheels on Meals. And
son, it's time we have a talk.
What, Dad?
Well, son, pretty soon you'll want to look at naked girls. Some movies have lots of naked girls and things that make you feel strange.
Like Sasha Grey videos?
Whoa, you've got to start off slow, son. Save the triple penetration gangbangs for when you get old and miserable. Savor the sight of bare breasts from a bygone era before they were a Google away.
Supper time, you two. And remember, no incestuous roughies or rapey pink films until after dinner.
The Trashy Trio, covering Euro sleaze, Japanese pink films, American roughies, or any other sordid entertainment that comes their way. The Trashy Trio, a podcast to listen to while alone, with headphones on, probably in your closet. Under some covers.
Welcome back, and the first review of Podcast on Fire 201 is Wheels on Meals from 1984, and plot from Dan Dan's review at HKMDB. Sylvia, played by Lola Miss Spain, 1979 foreigner, is a pickpocket who crosses paths with Thomas, played by Jackie Chan, and his partner David, played by Yung Bu, who run a mobile fast food joint in Barcelona. Thomas and David's friend Moby, played by Sammo Hung, a private detective, is employed to find Sylvia and her mother, but other interested parties are also on her trail, and therefore their trail. So there we are. Why don't you start us off with a brief opinion of Wheels on Meals, Tom?
Another classic Hong Kong film, a classic action film from a golden period. Probably the silliest and the goofiest of the Three Brothers films, the Lucky Stars films aside, but takes our heroes in. Injects them into this European setting for the first time in most of the cast and crew's career, you know, working with non-HK actors and filmmakers, and I think its unique flavour holds up very well.
I'm going to be the one that spoils the party here. It's India. I know I am. I knew that before. It's enjoyable, though, as a pleasant, somewhat muted comedy in parts, but simply put, you have to sit through a lot of Wheels on Meals to get to the good part of the movie. And for me, that's the action. In between, it doesn't strike a balance very well at all. But it's worth pursuing for Sammo's hard-hitting, powerful tint to the action.
It's worth pursuing for Sammo's perm. That's the only
thing. Well, yeah. Sammo's perm is worth the price of admission alone. But for me, it's the lesser of the Three Brothers collaborations. But, you know, you gotta watch it for the action. But it's a long movie for me to sit through to get to the parts that I find compelling.
It definitely takes time, I think, to really get going. It kind of teases with the action. It definitely does that kind of throughout the first hour, but then it really hits kind of those last kind of 40 minutes, so half an hour. So I think that's when
if the comedy in between had been to my liking, I wouldn't have as much of a problem with the 105 minute running time that we get here. But let's talk a little bit about the language of the film, right? I watched this movie with the original English dub that not only is The obvious difference is that everybody's dubbed in English versus everybody's dubbed in Cantonese, including the non-Hong Kong performers. But it also has a livelier score than the Hong Kong edit. If they are Spanish performers, right? Maybe they were talking Spanish to Sammo and so forth, and it would make Sammo would speak Canto, they would speak Spanish, and therefore English versus Cantonese, like, it wouldn't matter necessarily. But I just like it personally to hear it in English. And it's also a bit more above average in terms of how it's performed. We don't get the regular 70s crew that you hear in, for instance, Crippled Avengers. Like, you can't recognize so many voices, but this dubbing crew, the English one, has a bit more talent. It feels a bit more fresh than most of the dubs I hear. And so I like it personally in English, but also the score has something to do with that. I just remember the Hong Kong score versus the English score. Just made it a bit dull than the English score. Like, even like the opening sequence where Jackie and Yunbiu are working out in the morning. Even that is more livelier in the English score. But I probably wouldn't have thought of it had I not compared them, though.
Yeah, I agree. I think the original dub, and just so we're on the same line, it's the one where Richard Engel's character is dubbed like Ren from Ren and Stimpy.
Speak like this. Hello.
It is like that, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I do agree. Yeah, I mean, it definitely, the music is good in the dub. I think this is probably the dub as well as the one that most people kind of grew up with and look back favourably on. Kind of speaking to people and fans of the film, it seems like the dub's kind of, for this one, is seen upon very favourably. But I agree, yeah, it is a bit bizarre that those two separate soundtracks. I mean,
sometimes for different markets they did that. Yeah, like for instance, the Japanese market sometimes got different music and different versions of the movies as well. So
yeah, different songs used. And I think the Japanese version uses the English dub soundtrack, right? The Japanese audio track? So kind of different strokes for different folks, I suppose. But yeah, I can see your point there, definitely, Kenneth.
Let's go to the first fun scene. I mean, Sam crafts some very fun visual comedy as Jackie and Junpyo's character awake to welcome a new day. There is some very like promising gags here, where they obviously are living in separate rooms and they come out of separate doors, but it turns out the room has no wall because one of them stretches or something and the hand goes through like what you assumed would be the wall. So like good, it starts out, and the ladies gets a scene essentially here because you get slow-mo sweaty bots.
You do?
Trim, Jackie Chan and Yunbiu. So there is something for everyone here, including the ladies in this opening scene here.
Yeah, it's an awesome intro. I think all the characters' kind of instructions, including Samo's, is great. It really kind of sets them up in kind of, you know, not, you know, different roles. You know, I think obviously this is a massive leap from, you know, Project A. It's a massive kind of leap in terms of the characters and shifting around. Whereas kind of Yunbiu is more the authority figure in Project A, it kind of switches here, and he's more the kind of like, you know, shares a lot of the limelight with Jackie while kind of Samo's in the background doing his thing. So I think it's good. And I think it all, you know, kind of all three of their major collaborations is good at that. It kind of switches around the characters a bit so they're not all playing the same role.
I agree. It would have been easier to just ride on the coattails of what they did in Project A and not come up with any new ideas. So that's why all of these three come recommended.
I think they could have easily, the year after, they could have produced a quickie in kind of in Hong Kong somewhere, something just with the three of them, and it would have made money. But the fact that they go out of the comfort zone and they go to Spain and get this kind of, you know, this cast of Europeans, and it's good in this kind of, you know, this kidnap plot. It's really good. It's really, really good.
And before I started to kind of fall out of the movie, if you will, the beginning has some very sincere and well-timed slapstick, and because Yunbiu witnesses Lola Fawner for the first time, and while he's distracted by her, he throws water on this police officer. So it's that kind of simple but sincere and well-timed slapstick. I think they're washing their van at that point, so he throws water on the police that way. And speaking of Sam's intro, by the way, the dub again has him with a slight accent. He's performed with a slight accent. I feared a little bit, but I never thought in the end that accent was terribly racist or anything. They didn't go all stereotypical Chinese speaking English accent, but there is a slight, like, they're not making Sammo
Mr. Miyagi vibe going on there.
A little bit, rather than Sammo Hung as an American.
Stereotypical Oriental kind of vibe to it. I know what you mean, yeah, I know what you mean. There's an awful lot of chinks dropped in it as well, which is a bit... It's, you know, sometimes it's a bit like, oh, I don't know about that. But I mean, it was a time, and it was, you know, kind of a word that wasn't, you know, it was kind of just thrown about still, you know, without the, you know, the kind of, I don't know, the kind of the, you know, the power that it has today, really, kind of saying it, you know, in a kind of bad light. I think back then it was kind of a bit more thrown around. So I think you can get away with that and the kind of stereotypical, you know, Spanish accents a bit easier back then dubbing it than, you know, you could today.
Hell, even the British accent of Sam Hong's employer is overly posh.
I'm from England, apparently.
Sammo, I think, comes off the best here, especially in the early going in terms of comedy. He's this novice PI when the British client comes in, and what is it? He takes the paper and he kind of assumes there's invisible ink on the paper, so he splashes water on it and holds it against the light. And he just holds on himself directorially and realized that he messed up, that there's not going to be any secret message here, is it? And I love that Sam holds the camera on himself really tight while we kind of in real time realize with him what a fool he is. And for no reason, they have a high-tech meal van. Just because they could, I suppose. This is a wonderful meal van. So, want to share any specific notes on this very modern / sci-fi setup that they got here?
I mean, it's amazing. I mean, it's just amazing. I mean, things pop out of it and move into it and, you know, kind of things. And there's squirters in the back and that can be used as long-range weapons, apparently, which is amazing. Yeah, and it's good. It's really the heart of the film, isn't it, if you think about it? Like, it's kind of like it's their business, and it's kind of what they're, you know, they're trying to almost protect and what they keep, you know, they're kind of trying to earn a living. And then they get involved with Lona Fauna's character and kind of things go from there, and it's kind of the heart of the film, the old van is, and we get an amazing car chase with it as well, where some oranges get destroyed, which is great. And yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it looks good as well. It doesn't look all, you know, Doctor Who-esque, you know, not you know, shin on Doctor S, but it's on Doctor Who, but it's kind of like it still looks good, you know. It's not kind of the old you know, styrofoam kind of coming out and stuff. It still looks good, holds up.
It's a neat little piece of production design, also in tune with the time, because they have these panels inside the truck that illustrates what's going on outside. If the bench is being ejected, then you see computer graphics on little monitors and stuff like that, like graphics right out of Tron or something like that. Yeah. It's very charming, and
it looks good, man. It looks good. It is charming. Yeah, that's the right word.
This act of this choice and concept of going to Barcelona is not very desperate or kind of disgustingly boastful or anything like as you alluded to, it's variation that's very welcome rather than to shoot another very local Hong Kong comedy on their local stages and locations and comfort, you know, in the local comfort. So that's why these collaborations are kind of all recommend the Project A being a pirate movie, this being set in Barcelona, Dragons Forever being, I don't know what its trait necessarily is, rather than
it's the darkest. I think it's more like
a, I suppose it is,
crime,
yeah, yeah,
kind of movie. Yeah, it's definitely the darkest. I think that's its main kind of what it's bringing to the table in terms of the trilogy, as it were.
Hey, how would you rate them? Like, which would be your favorite out of these three?
I don't. I'm sure you asked me this on like another episode.
Just be a man and spontaneously.
I can't be a man.
Is it Wheels on Meals number one for you?
Wheels on Meals could be on a sunny day. You know, if it's raining outside, I'd prefer. No, it's. I couldn't. Man, I honestly couldn't. I definitely know. I prefer the trilogy, Project A, Wheels and Dragons, over the Lucky Stars trilogy. But that's the only thing I could say. I see them as kind of a whole film. It's, you know, it's like picking one of your children. It's like, even though I don't have children, but I kind of think that must be hard.
For me, it's Project A, Dragons Forever, and then this, because I just like the feel of Project A. This being such a big, fun Jackie movie, Dragons Forever being such a fun, dark Sammo movie, and this being kind of a mixture of them all, but me not liking it as much as the other ones, and I'll certainly explain why. My God, they were good to bring Blackie Coe over for some bicycle stunts, and they also got Blackie Coe into wardrobe, like you read about.
So good, like a punk, amazing, like a 1984 punk. Oh, so good.
And then it looks like they like cut his hair, kept the top, and then did a very awesome mohawk for Blackie Coe for his 5-minute scene.
So he's had to walk the streets of Barcelona like looking like that. He must have scared a few locals with that look. Like, who's that? You know, Chinese guy walking around like with the kind of the black eye makeup and the weird haircut. Oh, it's Blackie Ho.
But it really that scene where the local thugs kind of starts messing with the meal van and customers, I suppose. That scene shows the great fusion of comedy, light tone, and these show-stopping stunts. If you see the outtakes that are available on the Japanese version of the film, to knock both of them off took a couple of takes because it's just hard to hit someone in mid-motion while you're in mid-motion because they're riding the motorcycles at some kind of speed. Jackie or Samo or Jackie or Yun, one of them or both of them has to kick both motorcyclists, and it's a hard stunt to pull off if you really watch the outtakes. It's not easy to. You'd think that you have really need to train your mind and body to not avoid it.
You could tell, like, some of the outtakes as well. I mean, I haven't seen this time because I just watched the dub, but yeah, I have seen them before, and it just looks like they're kind of tired after. Like a couple of them, and I think that would happen. So you just kind of drain yourself, wouldn't you? And I think it'd be even difficult as it progressed to kind of put your full energy into it, and then you've got more chance of getting hurt. So for them to put the kind of effort into it, and to, it really is mad. And you see a few takes. It must have taken quite a few takes and quite a lot of energy to keep pulling off and keep pulling off consistency to look good on film.
They're not working with a rig or anything. That's just something they did. Opposite forces coming at each other. One on a motorbike, the other's gonna kick you off the motorbike, the actual human being. This is why Yunbyu is my favorite out of the three brothers. How can you not notice Yunbyu's black t-shirt, yellow shirt, sleeveless woolly jumper combo?
The fashion in this is definitely the best of the trilogy.
The sleeveless woolly jumper is just mwah.
It's mwah. Like for me, Jackie's jumper, like in the finale, is the pinnacle. Is just absolutely beautiful. Like, just the setups and Samo's suits throughout the film are phenomenal as well. The choices in this are great. I mean, I think at one point Yunbo's wearing about 4 polo shirts, isn't he? That's beautiful. Like, it's all about the layers, especially when it's boiling hot.
Yeah, I assume they went down to Spain during the summer season. It looks like it anyway. So they should have made one of those action figures based on Yunbyu's woolly jumper combo. Like, what's this?
Give me 10.
And we got some silly but very funny cameos. I love Wu Ma's mental patient. He's a mental patient, as is John Chum and Richard Um. But Wu Ma steers the show as the timekeeper. Yeah, he acts like a clock, and he, you know, rocks back and forth like tick tack tick tack. And someone asks him, "What's the time?" "Well, it's this and this." "No, it's this and this." "Oh my god, I'm behind!" "Tick tock tick tock tick tock tick tock." He needs to do it faster. You got some cool cameos. I'm sure they shot some of that in Hong Kong, but they did have Richard Um and John Chum interact with Keith Vitale at one point. So at least those two were in Barcelona.
Yeah, they must have brought them over to just film that one sequence.
Because that scene, and I'm taking this from the interview I did with Keith on a prior podcast on Fire, that scene where Keith Vitale kicks either Richard and or John Chum into the van was something Sammo Hung kind of gave him as a reward for doing well in prior scenes. Like, he called him up like, I got this scene for you, because he loved his kick and his kicking technique. So essentially, Sammo conjured up that scene for Keith, so that's why we get it in the film. And he's a mighty powerful kicker.
Amazing. I mean, we just say that both, you know, Keith and Benny in this, Benny Akidis, are just so good. Like some of the best Westerners captured in a Hong Kong film just ever. I mean, I think a lot of time, like, you know, a lot of the characters, Western characters, are somewhat kind of forgettable, especially as the, you know, you get into the 90s and stuff. I mean, I think the characters are don't really leave, you know, an impression on you, but these two just always did. I mean, I like the fact that they're not kind of shied away from, they're given a lot of the limelight to really shine, and like, they are such, like, the performances, especially towards the back end, are just, you know, phenomenal.
For the first half, all of this, like, mixture between a little bit of stunt, a little bit of action, more comedy and narrative focus works for me. And then it starts to drag. Not because it isn't loud and, like, grating Hong Kong comedy or anything, but I just thought I started to tune out of the movie because I didn't think he was, I suppose, engaging and pleasant enough, despite the team of Jackie, Yimbu, and Lola Fauna being, you know, it's not a bad team up. And I thought she always did well in these, I suppose, two movies she did with Jackie, this and Armor of God. You know, I always thought she was, like, held her own to a decent degree, rather than just being cast for looks and eye candy. Like, she, in this one, she's obviously a little bit of a con artist as well, and like
she's up for it. Like she's up for it. I'd say, like, in terms of like she the material she's given, like she goes with it. Like she really kind of makes it her own. I think it'd be very easy to give a very flat performance, but she doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's my kind of impressions of her.
I don't know if she had any prior, you know, skills or anything. If she just did the modeling and the whole Miss Spain win, if you will. But I always thought she obviously is and probably still is a very, very beautiful lady. And I thought she her casting always worked in these two movies. I think it was two movies she did with.
Yeah, Wheels and Armor of God. Was she in? She was in Project A as well. In a brief, I think that's where they got her from, because she's in a brief. She's the daughter, isn't she, of one of the?
Yeah, she's apparently credited as an admiral's daughter of someone British in that movie. So
that's it.
It is the weaker of the three collaborations for me, but neither is true low quality. As I said, I mean, if this would have been shorter, I think it would have been, I would have thought more positively of it. But again, I like that Jackie, Sammo and Yun didn't do more than three, essentially. They could have done five or six
They could have rode that train, buddy. They could have rode that train. But, you know, they took the time out and they all did different projects. And, you know, Sammo produced a lot and Jackie did his own thing and Yun did his own thing. And they could have, man. They really could have. With this film, they could have put out something that was so, you know, by the numbers and it would have still made money. But they didn't. You know, they kind of decided to make each one kind of different. And
because it could have been this, look at us, we're in Spain. And that could have been the extent of the efforts, like plus some action sequences. But Sammo does try to provide this pleasant comedy narrative. But I personally I didn't find much pleasure in watching this whole Yimbu is in love with Lola Fauna, Jackie's as well a little bit. And it didn't move efficiently forward to me. Whenever, and this is a rare thing for me, whenever there was even a punch, whenever there was action, I was so into the movie. And normally, when I'm out of the movie, sometimes the action could take a while to win me over, you know what I mean? But whenever Samus and the action team starts to do action, like this very brief fight in a hallway between Sammo and a couple of the Western players, doesn't last for long, but it's really that appealing power of Sammo that never fails.
Yeah,
at this time too, like I can never get tired of it. It always feels fresh the way he just goes from 0 to 100 in terms of power, and whether he's doing it himself or choreographing someone else to perform his vision, it's just that amazing. And I mean, there's a mighty long action team on this, you know.
Oh, I know, yeah. There's a lot of action directors on this film.
So, I mean, obviously, Sammo is there to steer it all, but it's a big team effort. But it feels more like his stamp on it all, because we don't get any kind of Jackie Chan juggling with props and being all balletic or anything. It's pretty much hard and powerful action throughout here, yeah.
Yeah. For sure. I think that's the best. Yeah, I mean, it does, like I said before, it only teases. You have those brief moments of power, like you said, and it kind of like, oh, what's that? And then, you know, it just gives us tiny little sprinklings until the last kind of half an hour or so. But, you know, as you've expressed, that can go either way. And I suppose with you, it's gone more to the way of, you know, getting a bit bored with kind of what was in between the action, which is a fair, very fair criticism.
And, you know, even the chase sequence with the van, as fun as it is when they, like, start shooting out oil out of the nozzles that they have in the van, onto the van, and you got some car stunts and all of that, it was part of the movie where I was kind of waiting for something to win me over. And that sequence, within the context of the movie, failed to win me over, you know what I mean? Like, it's a good executed car stunt sequence, but it's fine. But the fight action was, that really made me sit up all throughout, whenever it was done for 1 second, 30 seconds, or 5 minutes. You know, it really made me go, wowza. And that leads to, obviously, Benavidez, Okudas, and Keith Vitale were cast as hard-hitting, kicking Westerners. And as Keith said, they wanted him based on his rep as a martial artist on the sports scene, if you will. I know I'm not using the right terminology, but he was obviously a very famous kicker, on the scene, and a high-ranking belt and all of that. And he got to Barcelona, and I asked him, I'm pretty sure you never got a script before, during, or even shortly post-production, just to find out what you were doing. No, we just arrived. They asked us to stand there, and are you ready, Keith? As Samuel said, ready? I don't know what I'm doing. No problem. Work with Jackie. And I love Keith's story about watching Jackie essentially slamming his hands on his own knees, like, da, 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 da. And he asked Jackie, what are you doing? Oh, I'm working out the beat of the movie. And he really was impressed by how his thinking went. And he's probably referring to the scene when their first big fight scene, and they kind of beat up Jackie and Yumbu during that short fight scene. For someone, at least for Keith, who just was flown there and asked to be in the movie, he's incredibly powerful and effective in the movie for someone who just, I don't know what's going on here.
So, I mean, it's partly to do with obviously, Keith's talent within himself, but it's just the experienced guys, Samo, everyone kind of, I think they're really good at bringing that power out of him and making sure he looks, really good. For him to get it down like that straight away and kind of still look good, to kind of understand how they kind of choreograph the scene and get on with it and do it and look that good. I mean, that's...
Both really correspond to the Hong Kong energy. I didn't spot much or any doubling
them.
Because as characters, they're not acrobatic characters where you get the obvious cut to... like Yumbu doubling Keith Vitale or Benny Urquidez. Like, so Samuel cast them for power, and boy, do they come through, like, even before the big fight scene towards the end. So I really admire how they just were injected into this and really came out looking strong.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
And part of why the movie's rep, action-wise, is so strong is due to them as well. Like, not that they didn't take a lot of bumps on the movie, like the scene towards the end where Keith Vitale gets this vase or whatever smashed across his head pretty much was painful,
Yeah, you can tell.
And slow motion and everything, but he was happy, obviously very happy to do it. He even... There is a scene, I'm not sure where it is, but there is a scene where Keith kicks Jackie Chan, and when they were doing it, Keith went into his pose, and Samuel said, no, other side, because he had less control, let's say doing it from the right rather than the left, and he apparently kicked Jackie so hard over and over again, because they didn't get the take right. And, like, essentially, it sounds like he's bragging, he's not, but essentially he said he knocked out Jackie Chan multiple times because the angle was better from the side that he can't control as well, Keith, in terms of his kicking. But Sam, like, everybody was angry, apparently, at Keith. They were just shouting at him in Chinese, but you know who was smiling and who was happy? Samo. He was over the moon, like, it looks so good, it's awesome.
Getting what he wants.
And it's a wonderful kind of glimpse into the making of the movie that we'll link to, obviously, Keith's interview that I did with him. And he also touches on working on Revenge of the Ninja and the various seasonal movies as well, No Retreat, No Surrender 3 and Blood Moon. So it's a two-parter that we put up a year or two ago. Might as well touch on the ending a little bit. Long castle set fight ending, but boy is it long. But that's one part of the movie where I think it doesn't feel long. They don't overdo the action when they should have, like, reduced it with one fight or anything to make it flow better. No, I think all fights have its place, and especially since they're varied up, it's not like here is Jackie and Benny's fight, boom, cut to Yumbu and Keith Vitale's fight. No, they kind of mix and match, which I think is a way to keep us on board, you know what I mean?
Yeah, Samo knows kind of when to, cut away and when to kind of film. I suppose it's one of those things that he never cuts away when it's you know, knee deep into the action, you really want to keep watching that scene. It kind of just gives you with a bit, like a little hint as to what these two guys are going to get up to, and then kind of cuts away to another fight. And it as you say, yeah, it ends. It doesn't just end and the whole thing from beginning to end on another fight, and then the whole thing from beginning to end on another fight. It keeps switching between and kind of keeps, you know, variating enough. So I suppose a lot of that probably goes to Peter Chung as well. Obviously, he edited the film, so I think that's probably down to him a lot as well in terms of just keeping that kind of pace going between three separate fights, which is amazing. But that's what I love about that whole kind of back end. It's just so much variety there, and we get the stunts, and we get kind of each one is different as well. Kind of like Jackie's with Benny's more of a one on one. Yun Bao's uses a lot of kind of acrobatic flips to in his fight with Keith, and the Samuels is more kind of just brutal kind of one on one sword fight. So it's different as well, and I think that's what really helps you know, make the variety, give the variety that back end has.
And that Benny Urquidez fight versus Jackie, it really is part anyway, a boxing match. It's not like, oh, it's Wing Chun or it's this and this. No, it's boxing. And to my eyes, and this might be wrong, but maybe there Benny has gone on record and Jackie has gone on record on how this fight went, but it looks like full contact every now and again.
Oh, man. Some of those slow down shots with Benny getting hit. Yeah, it looks like he gets nailed. And it's the same with Jackie. There's a few like slow down shots, and you look and it's like, oof. But that's how Samuel rolls. You know, that's what he wanted, was that full contact. And we're here, you know, reaping the benefits of the way he choreographed and the way he directed.
Oh, very much so. And it reminded me a little bit of, because Benny is an opponent that Jackie doesn't take down in one round, if you will. And he is kind of afraid of him, and it reminded me a little bit of the Young Master fight.
Yeah.
Versus Wang Hsing, because in the Young Master, which is a way longer fight, Jackie is so afraid of him at one point. Like, he steps forward and then back, steps forward and then back, because he's such a mighty foe. So there was a little bit of a Young Master trickling in there for me, whether Samo and the action team meant to reference it or not. But really, no wonder he was brought back for Dragons Forever. I don't remember the particulars of that fight other than it was a quality fight. But so because this is so fresh in my memory, I think this is the better of there too, fights on screen. But hey, I might forgetting some painful highlights from the Dragons Forever fight.
You're not going to ask me again, are you? Which one's better?
I might, or I might not.
We just need to produce a supercut, and we'll just put them all together. So at the ends, you know, the beginning of, you know, Wheels, the end of Project A, and we'll just do that, and we'll add the best fight scenes from the Lucky Star series as well, sprinkled through, and it'll be the best film that was ever made.
I've never even seen yet, anyway, My Lucky Stars, but I know the gist of the series, which I can just kind of guess that the comedy in between is uneven, with Eric Tsang and Stanley Fung and everybody hitting on girls all the time.
It's a bit of a pick and mix, yeah. I think if you struggle with this film a bit, then you maybe struggle with that. But they're great films, they're fun films, but I think, they're just less consistent than these, you know, Three Brothers trilogy.
The first Lucky Stars movie we're probably going to do on the network is the one that Alan Tam is in. Because me and Phil G are doing our Alan Tam movies. Lucky Stars Go Places, I believe.
Yeah, the fourth one, I think. Yeah, 90 or something, I think. One of the later ones, isn't it? They did like two in the 90s. Or one in the late 80s and one in the early 90s, I think.
But regardless, that's probably the one we're looking at first. But obviously, they're not this connected story or anything.
That's how Ken does things. He goes to the Alan Tam, the one with Alan Tam first. Not the classic ones, the one with Alan Tam.
But even I saw Ghost Punting recently, speaking of Lucky Stars, and it's that formula again, which is hit and miss. Richard is always pretty funny, but it is like hitting on girls for about 75 minutes and a little bit of action. It's a pretty transparent formula, something that Jackie, Samo, and Yung Bu didn't adhere to. Formula. They varied it up, which is why, again, all of these three come recommended. I just think this is at least 10-15 minutes too long. Isn't as fun or pleasant as it tries to with the whole Lola Forner, Yung Bu, Jackie Chan triple act, because Samo is more sporadically interacting with them. By no means a bad film, and obviously I would recommend it, but if you're new to these collaborations, go with either Project A or Dragons Forever first, in my opinion. But do check out all three.
The one thing that always leaves, the kind of I get left with from this film, and you know, films kind of its ilk, it just feels, you know, so effortless. You know, never any ever like feels forced, or it feels like kind of gimmicky. It just feels so effortless, and everyone's having a, you know, good time and just delivering kind of what people want. Like, there's no fuss, or you know, there's kind of no pandering. It's just, you know, amazing kind of action cinema, amazing kind of funny action cinema from a golden period. And you know, this kind of stands alongside with the best, in my opinion.
But as for availability, it is available on both Hong Kong DVDs and Blu-ray, thanks to Fortune Star's remaster of the film. The Blu-ray isn't out of print just because the Blu-ray is out there. The Blu-ray features, as per usual, an upscale from the DVD, so there's no true HD version of the film on the Hong Kong Blu-ray. And both editions, actually, even the DVD, have remixes only. There's no mono options on the Hong Kong DVDs. Even there's not even that on the DVD. I double-checked, and there was a high-res scan of the back, and there was no mono listed. So
that's minus points, yeah.
Very much so. Knowing Fortune Star's track record, these are not going to sound good, these remixes. They'll have poorly laid-in effects and all of this. There is a decent option over in Japan. They fairly recently did a Blu-ray featuring the same upscale as the main movie, but as a bonus, and this has kind of been the track record for a lot of their Jackie Chan releases, as a bonus, you get a proper HD version from a Japanese 35mm print, which is actually the old English-dubbed export version, but with exclusive outtakes tacked onto it at the end. That is in mono, but reportedly the version in Japan had stereo music originally, so it should have actually been stereo, you know, if you would have presented it properly, but like stereo music, but mono effects. It's preferable that way, if indeed the remixes are in Hong Kong are so poor, you know. The old Hong Kong Legends special edition for the UK market did feature a new dub. It possibly is a mixture of, who knows, it's hard to find a dub. It's hard to legally obtain the dub, but you can fit it onto the Hong Kong edit because it is the same length. They didn't dub it onto a shorter edit or anything like that.
No, same. But yeah, that's always a bit of a mystery, but I think it must be with, like, as you say, who owns the rights to the dub. So, I'll stick with my good old VHS, which is what I do with this viewing.
But that DVD the UK market, I did an eBay search, and you got reasonably priced copies available, both the Australian version released of it and both the UK one. And they're reasonable also because it was a two-disc edition. So they're not like 20 quid, 30 quid versions out there on eBay, you know, below that even. So we are taking a break, and after that we are tracking back to The Shaw Brothers Days, 1978's Crippled Avengers by Cheng Che. You know, it's better than the remixed version of that. You know, when they did 5.1 on their DVD, Celestial, they even remixed the Shawscope logo.
Oh no. Did they put any Casio keyboard effects over it?
Well, compared to some of their remixes, the remixing of the logo was genius, but it's got way too punchy, boom, you know, for instance, but it's not the same. But for Crippled Avengers, I think they, at least the version I own, it's good old as the Shawscope logo should sound. So, but we'll be back to discuss Crippled Avengers from 1978 after a promo break.
Yo. Are you looking for a podcast that breaks movies down like you couldn't believe? I mean, takes them apart piece by piece and analyzes every little thing, getting you the most out of every movie that you ever could. Well, look no further than The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema with Samurai and Big Willie. These fuckers know how to review movies, or my name ain't the head.
You can find The Gentleman at ggtmc.com.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
Welcome back, and the second review of this episode is Crippled Avengers from 1978, and plot from Cal42's review on Hong Kong Movie Database. This one's basically about a rogue lord played by Shen Kuan-tai, who, having had his family killed or handicapped in an attack at his home, becomes obsessed with disabling anyone who stands up to him. He and his son, who had both his arms sliced off and replaced with iron prosthetics, played by Lu Feng, one of the Venoms, basically bully their way around town after this point. Coming up against him results in one man losing the power of speech and hearing, one man losing his sight, another his legs, and finally one man is reduced to having a childlike mentality. These men group together, and these are the rest of the Venoms cast: Philip Kwok, Lo Meng, Sun Chen, and Chiang Sheng. Wei Pai is not in this movie. He was the fifth or sixth Venom or whatever. Fifth, obviously. And they go to Eagle's mansion, where they spend 3 years training after being hurt, and they learn to work together to compensate for each other's disabilities. So let me start us off here. Largely a very fun movie, managing to depict its on-screen concept in a very fun and outlandish way. Because the first half has such a great pace, and fun aura. It dips a little post the training sequences, and some of the action is a bit more acrobatic than fight.
Agree.
You know, in the latter stages, but largely it's a fun, simple, less talky and complicated Shang-Chi movie from this period.
Agree. Shang-Chi manages to match Five Venoms for me in terms of the plot and the emotional kind of highs he brings to the film. And I think, call it a gimmick if you will, but I think the disabilities, that angle really elevates the material.
It's really fun. Like, when you first see, obviously, Lu Feng's iron hands, like,
shoot like little arrows, like,
awesome! Like, all right! But, you know, some movies ease us into the drama, some are more quiet. Cripple Avengers is not.
What, man? It's like the opening, like, what is it? Like, the first 2-3 minutes we get, a poor woman getting kind of cut in half, and then, kid's hands getting lopped off, so.
Chen Kuan-tai's wife's legs are cut, and his son's arms are cut off by the little trio that arrives at his house, including Dick Wei. Dick Wei is the one who don't fancy killing women, but his friend certainly doesn't think that way. Chop! So it's like uber cool violent in a way. Like, all right, this is super violent. I wonder what this is going to turn out like. This is going to be a revenge story for the ages. Like, because now dad got to build, as we see a minute later, he has built iron hands. Like, the seventh pair is the one that works out.
Oh,
like,
no, it's so random, isn't it? So five and six were close, but seven, definitely.
Like, the other pairs, one of them, like, had its own life and start punching Lu Feng in the head. Like, oh my God, we gotta tweak that. But you'd think, considering how fast this moves, that it's going to be over in 30 minutes. But there is a twist to all of this, obviously, as we said in the plot outline. And it's very sad. Sadistic in the way they cripple anyone here,
It just seems like fucking uncalled for, a lot of it. I love it. I love the fact that, you know, it's done, and we get these guys that are awesome because of it. But it's like, it's so like, what did he say? Oh, just do him in, like, blind him. It's like what? Like, really? What?
Not even 30 minutes in, Chen Kuan-tai and Lu Feng have gathered kind of the guilty parties to go at them. Not kill them, but cripple them. And some of them die, or maybe all of them die, and boom. Now we can go home. The movie is over. But no, Chen Kuan-tai and Lu Feng, they're drunk on power by this point.
So they turn into the bad guys. They're really kind of the good guys in the beginning and out for revenge. And then they kind of turn to the bad guys within the first, you know, a few minutes. It's crazy. It kind of flips it on its head, which is cool.
I kind of do think it's cool because and it all moves very fast. We don't get to wait half a movie for this. They're not the good guys.
The good guys. Yeah, true.
And it's not like Shang-Chi depicts them in an uber evil way or anything. Like, we could believe that, we could side with them, you know what I mean? Like, we probably could. But I do like that change very much, in that they're so, by that point, they're so sensitive to anyone. Like, I think when they're at the inn at one point, someone spots, like, are you shaking your hands at my son? Get him! You're mocking him! So that's good fun. And then they just, boom, out goes Philip Kwok's eyes, which I don't know, it's probably on your version as well. We often get during Chang'e movies anyway, because they're so bloody. Sometimes full-on red screens and then the aftermaths of violence. And that is actually not style, Tom, but that's censorship. That's how they censored some of Chang'e's violence, by just putting in a red screen while the sound effects, you know, and then we see him rolling around on the floor in slow motion without the eyes and all of that, so...
Yeah, that does happen like throughout. Kind of, there's a lot of his films, isn't it, really, that are kind of still presented that way?
I remember Heroes 2 had a lot of that. For a Chang'e movie, a lot of these red screens. It's not like they did this massive gore effect or anything.
It fits with the material, I think, doesn't it? Like
exactly. Kind of... We obviously get it. It's not like, hey, why are they in another location now? It's not that. Because they're so evil, these guys. They cripple these poor guys in such heinous ways. And you do side with them later in the movie, but it's so much fun seeing Chang'e just, yeah, you're getting it, and you're getting it, and you're getting it. Legs off, arms off, brain gone.
That's it. I mean, yeah, it's like, I mean, I actually welled up a bit when we first see Philip Kwok, you know, leaving the tea house, and he's now blind.
Yeah,
it's really well done. I mean, with that musical cue appearing, that kind of was at the beginning, that kind of shows up a few times. It's really sad. I was like, oh man. And I think old Kwok, he's like, you know, he's my favourite of the Venoms, and to see him like that, I was like, oh man, what have they done to him? So sad.
There's also quite, on that note, there's also quite an effective moment for the muscle man, Lo Meng, because he goes deaf and mute.
That's so good.
So they what they do is that they mute the audio completely to kind of replicate that experience of him just not being able to communicate at all.
It's so well done. I mean, it's really effective. They cut back to it like a few times during the film. The kind of what he can, you know, obviously can't hear anything, like being in his shoes. But yeah, the bit when they mute it and then they kind of slow down the scene and then they cut back to the shouting of the crowd, and you can't hear the crowd. You know, you can't hear the crowd at first, and then you can. It's like he's screaming and it's completely silent. It's really, really well done.
It is, and we'll probably get to why this is a bit more simplified Chang'e for this period, but it's very swift, and we get prompt introductions, we get prompt harm, because he gets the gang together pretty quickly for this being the crippled gang, the crippled Avengers. It's such an unusual kung fu movie template, as far as I can remember, that also they managed to execute it overall. That's the thing. It could have been maybe a independent production wouldn't have been able to execute it like this, but having Shaw Brothers being able to produce some, you know, effective props and all of that for these various, like Lu Feng's hands again.
Yeah.
Good that it started at Shaw Brothers. I'll have some notes later where independent production did riff on this one. But yeah, in terms of fight action, the first very great fight scene, there are a couple of ones, and there are a couple of ones that are not as great, but Chang'e versus Johnny Wang and his ball chain. My God, I love that stuff. It's a real mixing their acrobatic skills, them being Peking opera performers, Chang'e and the rest of the Venoms. But him versus Johnny Wang in this scene is just marvelous looking, detailed and intricate and fairly long choreography that these movies sometimes did really well when they weren't focusing on acrobatics as such. Some of the fight scenes in these movies, weapons fight scenes especially, were just, you know, elite.
Some of the weapon stuff in this is really, really good. I think it gets a bit kind of convoluted towards the back end, probably as you kind of touched upon, with it being too much. I don't want to go into it like now or speaking up again, but yeah, it kind of gets a bit too much when the first few scenes of it arrive, especially the Iron Ring stuff as well. It's really fantastic, really well choreographed.
I mean, it works with the Johnny Wang and Chang'e because he is, you know, light on his feet, while Johnny Wang is, you know, a bit heavier presence,
very grounded,
and he's got the weapon. So that mixture works very, very well. And, you know, having a Peking opera performer versus a more heavier martial artist in this case. And it's one movie where, like, Johnny Wang does get to fight for Chang'e. Not for once, but I remember Five Venoms, he appears in, and he doesn't fight at all in it. And I heard a rumor, anyway, that he was kind of in the Chang'e doghouse, like he was being punished.
Punish for not, yeah, that's
for something.
Bizarre.
I don't
know.
That's
bizarre, that is.
And it's important to mention that from the Five Venoms essentially and onwards, these performers were, you know, these peaking opera performers from Taiwan were brought in to kind of, it became a new kind of feel and vision for Chang Chieh's action cinema. Not always good, but there are some good examples of when they gathered in movies. I'm not a great fan of Five Venoms. I liked Invincible Shaolin a lot more, and I like this a lot. So, by the way, this had the aka of Return of the Five Deadly Venoms. You get people in that way. I don't know where they got Mortal Kombat from, though. Which is another AKA.
Bit strange, if I'm being honest. What, I don't think Mortal Kombat was even out at that point, was it?
It's a Mortal Kombat with a C, which is completely different.
They're trying to be cool, yeah. We're going to do it with a C instead of a K.
I don't know if it's politically incorrect to go with Crippled Avengers, but talk about a distant relative to the original title, Mortal Kombat.
There are mortals and they are in combat, so there's that.
What was the Angela Mao movie that got almost a porn-like title? It was one of her Golden Harvest movies. It kind of riffed. Oh yeah, either When Taekwondo Strikes or Hapkido, I believe, got the AKA in America that goes as follows: Deep Frost.
Oh yeah. There's probably going to be a few disappointed people that went and see that film.
Yep. So there you are. So sometimes that's marketing for you. Speaking of what I personally, why it isn't my favorite Chang Chieh period, it's more uneven than the first half of the 70s, essentially, and it's also different. But different isn't bad. Like, he wanted to change up things. I mean, he was such a frequent filmmaker. Sometimes any filmmaker, and especially a frequent filmmaker, needs to change it up. That's fine. But some of the movies were so talky and stretched out during this period. I remember Flag of Iron being this awful, boring, talky movie. But earlier in the 70s, he did it as well. He had like this two-hour youth drama starring way too old to play youths. Actors like David Chang, Dick Long, Chen Kuan-tai, Generation Gap, you know, stuff like that. And there was such patchwork movies, like, let's show what the young ones do. They sing, they drum, they play basketball.
Yeah.
For 2 hours!
Yeah. No kind of tap really on what the actual youth are about. It's kind of like, yeah, kind of...
David Chang plays the drums. That's okay.
David Chang
fine.
Is 12 and plays drums.
Yeah. He looks 25, but he's a youth, all right. You get like 10 Tigers from Guangdong or off Guangdong, which was just this incoherent mess. And don't get me started on the Brave Archer movies. We're obviously talking wuxia fantasy movies. I challenge you, Tom, to make a correct summary of the plot throughout these three movies. Oh my god. He obviously took written work, used three movies to convey it.
Yeah, it was a book, wasn't it? Or something.
It's probably a Jin Jong novel or Gulong novel.
Yeah.
But it was just this incoherent mess that wasn't fun as a fantasy movie either, the Brave Archer movies. And Chang Chieh was really uneven at this point.
Would you argue that the Five Venoms kind of saved his career, but really gave him that kind of burst of energy much needed after that kind of early 70s period? That kind of mid-70s period?
Well, see, I don't have the timeline in front of me whether it was kind of a mixture of first Five Venoms, then some boredom, then some more Five Venoms, and then some boredom. So I really shouldn't answer that. But it certainly is the more, although I'm not a huge fan of the Five Venoms, it's the more appealing nature of his cinema at this time. But we'll get to when kind of he let these performers do too much of their thing. We'll get to that. But this world of Crippled Avengers, it makes it all plausible in the name of fun entertainment. Like, we don't question that they build these prosthetics for Sun Chen's legs and that he has no problem walking on them in a couple of minutes of screen time. We don't, and we shouldn't. It's just fun that they build these legs, and that's going to pay off in such a fun way.
Oh, man. I know. He's obviously, he's underused in the film, I think. But it's because he's so powerful and he's kind of shown to be so powerful that he couldn't just have him going in there because he'd just fucking destroy everyone straight away. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah.
they kind of keep him in the shadows a bit because his training sequence is probably my favorite. Man, he comes out and he just fucking nukes those wooden dummies. He kicks the shit out of them, and then he gets those like wooden poles or fucking candles or whatever they are. I think there was a 2-for-1 sale at fucking Mark Spencer, because he comes out and just chucks all these fucking candles at him. It absolutely destroys them, and it looks so good. I think that's probably my favorite one. Favorite training sequence,
and the training sequences are they go on for a bit too long, and that's why the movie gets into trouble. But as they start, they're off to a great start. You know, Philip Kwok piercing the leaves because he's training his hearing. It's just so well conveyed and in such a fun way that they shoot this. And I think at least Chang Cheng was on the action team. Chang Cheng, Lu Feng, and Robert Tai, which was behind the scenes performer. He was not part of the Venoms. But for performers that they brought in without extensive, anyway, film experience, it looks great. And it's really exhilarating the way they these training sequences are conveyed. And by the way, speaking of Sun Qian's legs, in the remake, the dubstep 3D remake, they would have 3D printed that shit, obviously.
They would 3D print that shit, clearly, yeah.
I like the Lawman training sequence where he has to break the urns or the bottles behind that fire wheel that they spin. And he does it. And then we move on to Sun Cheng, obviously. But then Chang Che cuts back to Lawman, who is apparently not finished with his training, because he does that same thing again. And that's where I think the movie gets into a bit of trouble, that it goes on a little bit of a repeat.
Yeah, I don't think, for me, the training stuff, I mean, especially with the Iron Ring stuff is fantastic. With is it Cheng Cheng and Philip Kwok again, the both of them dueling with it is amazing. And obviously the spinning fire wheel, where he has to kind of break the, is it Lo Meng that has to...
Because it's not like he fails at it the first time.
No. It just gets smaller. It just gets smaller and smaller. They bottle us.
Oh, maybe that was it. Gotcha. Well, I'll take that back, because I didn't spot any variation of, like, why are they doing it again? He was awesome at it the first time.
Yeah, no, I think that it's smashing the kind of the juggies, and I think it gets smaller and smaller each time to me, and that's why he does it again. But for me, I found the training stuff enthralling. It's just the back end. I think it gets too repetitive during the back end with some of the stuff, and it keeps going on and kind of really grinding the point of that these guys are really good at, you know, from what the training kind of, you know, has made them into. Whereas the training for me, it was great the whole way through, and never had a problem with it.
Yeah, and obviously when they come back to town, they're equipped with certain things to kind of get a leg up in the fighting. Lawman is equipped with a couple of mirrors and stuff like that, like to spot opponents from coming up from behind him, I suppose. And it's really a bunch of clever ideas brought to the screen. And at one point, I think when they try to distract Kwok Choi by having a lot of cymbals going on at the same time, which is like almost peaking opera rhythms as he tries to find his rhythm, which is clever too. But it goes into territory where it can look a little stagey and slow when it's hand-to-hand choreography, but when weapons are involved, it's thrilling.
Yeah, it really picks up massively. Every time kind of someone pulls out a weapon, it is really, really, really good. But yeah, are you talking about the back end? Some of the handheld stuff towards the handheld, some of the kind of hand-to-hand stuff at the back end? Because I felt a bit like that.
Well, the problem there is for the, it's had a couple of good, gory, surprising deaths and all of that. The Muscle Man fight, I'm not going to spoil it more than that.
I enjoyed those fights, but you know what else I thought? I thought there was the introduction of too many characters at the back end. And it feels a bit unnatural, and the kind of where they start demonstrating amongst themselves kind of how good they are. I got a bit bored. I just wanted to get on with the main plot. I'm more interested in what our heroes are up to. And I know it was they had to, because it kind of set up the finale, you know, these cool kind of opponents to go against. But it felt like it was all too much. It was like two or three characters kind of one after another, and it's kind of like, you know, a bit forced. But they're obviously just trying to extend that period in between the guys training and the end fight, you know, with Chen Kuantai. I understand why it was done.
Yeah, and in the whole end fight, I mean, it's obviously competent, but the lean towards less cool hand-to-hand and more acrobatics and, well essentially, they're all seemingly at one point flipping and doing acrobatics rather than fighting. And I thought that was more like showcase rather than effective end fight choreography. You know, they're obviously super talented acrobatics, but at one point with Lu Feng, Philip Kwok, and maybe Sun Chen, just for the sake of naming a third one, because it was like a 2-on-1 fight, it just was a lot of flipping. and avoiding hitting each other. And I thought that was not compelling for the end fight, you know.
It kind of, that stuff was okay. I think the Iron Ring stuff really just keeps repeating itself. You know, when it gets into kind of that with the props, and you will always send the prop stuff kind of that escalates it. But there I felt like it got really good, and then it kind of just kept going on and like over and over, the same kind of moves and same stuff. And it was, as you say, it was kind of avoiding each other and just the really cool kind of flips and stuff. And it was like, come on, like, I know it's great, but just let's start hitting each other, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it was kind of like, oh, it's a bit too much now. But yeah, I think it is a bit controversial, but I do think the final fight is just a bit too long for me. I mean, it's about 15 minutes, and I think about 10, 11, 12 minutes are good. There's definitely a few minutes there that could have been cut out, maybe, just to kind of just tighten it up a bit.
Yeah, it's not an overlong film, but definitely a few minutes could have made a difference. I think it's a 100-minute film, so it's not this two-hour epic or anything. Good fun, and a concept that's brought to the screen in a very fun way. It could, like, in another filmmaker's hands and with lesser means, meaning budget, it could have been like very lame, I suppose. But
that's what I think. Yeah, it's good because it's because of the talent on board, that the material, it kind of it elevates everything rather than kind of hindering it. I mean, yeah, I just think we forgot to mention the characters' intros are awesome, because with the names kind of casually popping up on the screen alongside them when they get introduced. Instead, at the beginning, you get the loads of credits. Like, every time a character is introduced, the action doesn't stop. Their name just pops up next to them. I thought that's awesome. Yeah, I thought I'd just add that.
It appeared in a lot of movies that way. And it's fun. It's helpful. But when it's a lot of characters, they're doing it in one go. I remember the 14 Amazons, one of the earliest scenes with all the ladies. They kind of do it all in a short span of time. Like, cut to Lily, her name. Cut to whoever next, cut to whoever next, like in the same room. That's all they're doing for a couple of minutes. Like, all right, get on with it. But maybe it's all like it's done in one go, and then you get an awesome movie after that. The 14 Amazons is a classic of female fighters. I mentioned that this would lead to to other crippled Avengers movies, but it would lead to actual crippled Avengers movies. And what I mean by that, there were some independent, I believe, Taiwanese movies made among other crippled master and two crippled heroes that featured actual handicapped and awesome performers.
I did not know about this.
One of them had this deformed hand, one of them had no legs and all of that, and it smells of exploitation when you put these kind of characters in a movie. But I gotta tell you, they were awesome. They're awesome action performers, and that they managed to turn it around into good entertainment for these characters too, or these actors, these persons, these humans as well. They could lead a martial arts movie very, very effectively. So I've seen two of them. I believe they made three, that team. Crippled Master, Two Crippled Heroes, and I think one is called Fighting Life. And that one I haven't seen, but there were a couple of ones that just did what Crippled Avengers did. And these actors and performers were not handicapped in any way. I believe the Four Invincible was one, which was cool because they kind of gathered in the main cast some of these actors that normally were put as side cast. You know, some of the cross-eyed fellas and some of the uglier performers, so to say, were put as leads for, like, they were the crippled Avengers, and they did well too. The Four Invincibles is really,
that's
really
cool,
good fun. So
that's cool.
So as much exploitation as it could have led to, some of the copies and ripoffs were kind of fun. And as for availability, this is a Shaw Brothers movie, as we stated. So Celestial remastered it for Hong Kong DVD release, and it's still available, at least on Yes Asia. Dragon Dynasty did a DVD for the US market under the title Return of the Five Deadly Venoms, and it came with Mandarin language subtitles and also the English dub for the film. And that is also still in print. And the German label ELEA Media put out a decent looking Blu-ray with Mandarin and German language as well as English subtitles. So if Hong Kong doesn't do it, then someone else could step in and do it for them. And it's cool that DVD got, Blu-ray got English subtitles as well. Pretty, fairly expensive, but if you want it on Blu-ray, you can get it from the German Amazon. So It looks pretty good and natural and all of that. And mono too, so it's probably yes. I don't know what the if the Hong Kong DVD had 5.1 audio or not, because I never owned it. But that's for you to find out if you buy it on Hong Kong DVD. But anyway, next time I plan to bring in Paul Fox to kind of mix up the co-hosts as per usual, and we thought we'd kind of complete the Bruce Lee run by looking at some exploitation. So we start with, therefore, watching Robert Klaus and company try and piece together Game of Death into something honorable. Which they, I can say already, it's not very honorable. Game of Death contains some of the most offensive and disturbing footage in a Bruce Lee movie. And you know which one. I mean, they weren't the only one, but I think they were the first one to feature that horrible funeral footage. And we might as well pair it up with one of the better and more regarded Bruce exploitation movies, where we mix, not we, but they did, mix footage of Bruce from Enter the Dragon and various past movies, and the Bruce copy playing his brother. And that is the movie Game of Death 2, aka Tower of Death. Take it to the graveyard!
Yuen Biao kicking ass in that film, without anyone knowing it's him, apart from us.
I don't remember much exploitation in that movie other than they, for half a movie, kind of like, oh, it's totally Bruce Lee in this movie. It's not footage from Enter the Dragon, which it obviously is. But after the halfway point, it's Bruce Lee's brothers.
Cool film, man.
Good fun. So Game of Death 1 and 2 for the next episode, hopefully. So that's that. Let's finish it up by doing some quick contact information again. And this has been Podcast on Fire. We are on podcastonfire.com. And make your choice over there. We got a bunch of shows for you. If you have any feedback or comments, please let us know. Our email is podcastonfire@googlemail.com. Join the discussion over at Facebook and like our page. The discussion group and the page are linked to in the show post on the website. Our Twitter handle is at Podcast on Fire, rather. But my website is sogoodreviews.com, where I write about Hong Kong movies, Taiwanese movies, Godfrey Ho Ninja movies, and a variety of movies. And I also do video reviews at sleazykvideo.com, and my Twitter handle is at sogoodreviews. And you can subscribe to Podcast on Fire over at iTunes, rate and comment. If you have the time, please leave a written comment. We would love to hear from you. And finally, stream us on Stitcher Radio, either via their website or the applications available on the Apple App Store or Google Play. And that's that. And Tom, as we said, have a little great and fine writing archive, review archive, over at vcinemashow.com. So check out his sporadic writing on a variety of Hong Kong movies.
Thank you. That was the best one I think you've done for me. That was really good.
But anyway, we are done for this episode that covered Wheels on Meals and Crippled Avengers. So I hope you enjoyed, and let's say goodbye. I've been Kenny Beon, and with me was Tom KW. So say bye, buddy.
Goodbye.